Case number 12-7101. Fran Heiser, individually and as co-administrator of the estate of Michael Heiser et al. Appellants v. Islamic Republic of Iran et al. Mr. Cather for the appellants, Mr. Kerr for Appellees Wells Fargo Bank et al., and Mr. Schultz for Amicus Curiae USA.
May it please the Court, Dale Kapp on behalf of the appellants. The appellants are the family members and estates of the victims of the 1998 Kobar Tower bombings in Saudi Arabia.
Could you lift that microphone?
Yeah. Lift the lectern. Pull it up.
You can have that come up so it's closer.
I don't know why you tall guys were always reluctant to lift up the lectern. We had that yesterday.
I was afraid I was going to mess it up when I pressed the button.
No, lift it up.
Your Honors, when you take a look at this case, there's various issues that we've raised in both of our briefs. But what this case really comes down to is the definition of the word of. There's two statutes that are at issue, the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act and the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, specifically Section 1610G of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act. And the provisions that are at issue are pretty brief. In the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, the phrase that's at issue is the blocked assets of that terrorist party. And in Section 1610G of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act, the phrase that's at issue is the property of a foreign state. At the district court level, the district court and what the appellees argued before this court is that the word of, in the context of these two statutes, means ownership. And the appellees in the district court both relied on the Supreme Court's ruling in the Stanford case, which was a case that dealt with the interpretation of the phrase invention of the contractor in the context of patent law. In that case, looking at over 200 years of patent law, the Supreme Court found that the word of denoted ownership. And what the district court and what the appellees have now done is they've transferred that reasoning to essentially say that in this case, and in pretty much every case, the word of means ownership. However, our position is the position that the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York in the Hauser opinion case, that's 845F sub 553, has adopted that the use of the word of in these statutes doesn't mean ownership. It means one of the other 19 definitions that you find in the Webster Dictionary, which means associated with or related to. Specifically, there are multiple terrorist states where judgment creditors have judgments against those states. You have Syria, you have Iran, you have the Sudan. And what the court in Hauser and what we have argued below suggests is that the use of the word of in the context of these two statutes means that a judgment creditor of Iran can only attach against assets that were blocked due to a nexus with Iran. We can't attach against assets that deal with Syria or Sudan or any other type of terrorist state. And that's what we've held. And the reality of it is that if the court agrees with that analysis, the case really ends. And the reason that we support that analysis is you've got to take a look at the legislative history. It's without doubt that there are multiple definitions of the word above. But TRIA, which is the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act, and the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act were enacted to allow judgment creditors to, in fact, get some type of recovery. As this court has noted in prior opinions and as multiple other courts have noted, judgment creditors against terrorist states have had a really tough time with respect to collecting assets. So what Congress did is Congress enacted TRIA and enacted Section 1610G to make it abundantly clear that it was the intention of Congress to allow these victims to collect. And with respect to TRIA, it was the intention of Congress to collect against any blocked assets that have been blocked due to a nexus with that terrorist state. And what you can do is you can take a look at the definition of blocked assets is actually contained in TRIA. And the definition of blocked assets in TRIA essentially means any asset that the federal government has blocked under the Trading with the Enemy Act or the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, i.e., any asset that has been blocked due to an interest or a nexus of Iran, if you're an Iranian adjustment creditor, or Sudan, if you're a Sudan adjustment creditor.
You can't get the definition of out of the definition of blocked asset.
Right.
I mean, your case, your position rests on the proposition that of means something other than ownership. So you can't go to the definition of blocked assets and say, well, that shows that of means something other than ownership.
It's like a circular argument, Your Honor. You're right that the definition of blocked assets doesn't say of, but the definition of blocked assets shows the intent of Congress. Congress was on knowledge as to what type of assets were in fact blocked when it enacted TRIA. Every year, the Department of Treasury provides reports to Congress as to what assets have in fact been blocked, and they know that some of these assets are assets that perhaps don't have title, as we would know under state law, title in the name
of. There's a perfectly obvious explanation for why the Department of Treasury office would block assets that were not the property, not owned by, in this case, Iran. I mean, even if the money that's flowing in electronic transfers is not, the only connection is there at the end of the line, it's an Iranian bank. But by blocking those assets that are moving, the Treasury Department deprives Iran, in this case, of the opportunity to participate in the international financial community. That doesn't mean that Iran has an interest in those particular assets other than participating in the international finance community. But the question that troubles me about this is that under your proposition, that money belongs to somebody other than Iran, and that money will be used to satisfy a judgment because of what Iran did. And that is what Judge Lamberth made that point several times in his opinion, as I recall. What's your answer to that?
Well, my answer, Your Honor, to that is really twofold. The first thing is with respect to whose money it is. The whole reason that these statutes have been enacted that allow the blocking is to make it very clear that the foreign policy of the United States is to prohibit these terrorist states and these proliferator of nuclear weapons from engaging in the economic norms of the world community. So they put the world community on notice that you should not do business with Iran, and if you do, there are consequences. And one of the consequences is that if you engage in a transaction that comes through the United States, the transaction is going to get blocked.
But that doesn't tell you that Iran has the property interest that is required under the statute.
Well, for
under G1, the property of is what we're looking for. The fact that the government has a broader reach than what you see in G1. I mean, it's like Judge Randolph said, it's just not. It's not surprising that they have a broader reach to protect our national interests that go beyond what we would find if we look to see, in fact, whose property is that.
I understand, Your Honor, and I don't necessarily disagree that the federal government can have a broader interest than what a traditional state court judgment creditor exercising collection rights could do with respect to attachment property. But I think Congress also knew when it enacted TRIA, it also knew what the executive branch was doing and what type of assets the executive branch was, in fact, blocking, including assets that might not have your traditional notions of title being in the name of Iran.
Yeah, but the problem that Judge Randolph is pointing you to, that Chief Judge Lamberth, when he was Chief Judge, said, is that we may make a mistake under your theory, and you're taking money that doesn't belong to the state from whom you're trying to get it.
And
we're insisting on a requirement of property, and there are ways that we do this under established rules of law. No one doubts that the rules are not in dispute. And you can't capture some of the monies that you're seeking to get because there's no determination that's been made that it It is the property of the state against whom you have a judgment. And we're insisting that you have to make that showing first, because we don't want any mistakes is one of the other reasons.
Sure. Your Honor, I think there's two responses. Our position, which I know we respectfully disagree, is we don't need to show that Iran actually owns the blocked asset under TRIA. Our position is that Congress enacted TRIA with the understanding as to what type of assets were blocked and wanted to make all of those assets that have been blocked for an Iranian creditor, any assets been blocked due to a nexus with Iran.
That's
too.
A very different statute. That's a pretty easy statute to write. Well, if that's what Congress wanted to do.
But Your
any
Honor,
assets that have been blocked, you can go after.
But
you
Your
don't
Honor,
have to have all these additional language.
Sure. Your Honor, I also think that it could be easy if Congress wanted to say that Iran had to, in fact, own the asset. I think they could have said that in the statute. They could have said that
they may have said that. That's
and it gets us back to the definition of that we're
right.
arguing about.
Let me ask you another question.
Sure.
Under G3, what do you do with G3? That, putting it in terms other than the actual language of the statute, it seems to say that if a person has an interest in this property or asset, that person is not liable under the judgment that is the underlying judgment, then the courts can protect that person's interest. Well, all 11 accounts here are the interest is by persons who were not liable under the judgment.
Right.
Isn't that directly contrary to your position there?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. Actually, the second point that I was going to make actually ties into that. And the concern that Your Honors have raised is how do you protect whatever interest that some other third party who we don't have a judgment against and who may not be an agency in the mentality of Iran, how do you protect whatever interest that they have? And I think the way you protect is what Judge Lamberth has done with respect to the other assets that aren't before the court, which is really what's addressed here in Section 3, is that you can, and we've done this in other cases, what you do is you have a proceeding where you put, for instance, in a blocked wire, you send out notice and you allow every single party in the stream of the transaction, originating bank, beneficiary bank, the intermediary, you allow everyone to participate. You allow those parties to come to the court and to state why their interest is superior to the judgment creditor's interest. And we, you know, our position is our interest is based upon the statute in TRIA that allows us to attach against blocked assets. So the solution is you give people notice, you allow them to come to court, and you allow them to state their claim.
Yeah. Do you make any distinction between the use of the word asset in the 201A and the use of the word property in 1610G?
I think 1610G is broader. It's the use of the word asset in TRIA, I think you have to tie it to the word directly prior to it, which is the block assets. And I think property in 1610G is dealing with not just block assets, but any type of property.
I think of it in terms of the balance sheet with assets and liabilities, that if there's an asset on which there is, that it can be valued at $100 million, but there's liability attached to it of $50 million. One way of looking at this is that you can take the $100 million without netting out the liability.
Well, I think you come back to Section 3 in the process. If someone else has any interest in the asset, I think if you have a liability, say you're a secured creditor and with a mortgage instrument.
Yeah, but that's under G. That's under 1610G. There's no such provision under 201A.
I agree with that, Your Honor. There isn't a provision. I think our position, I know that we respectfully disagree, is that with respect to TRIA, which is different and which I think is even broader than 1610G with respect to blocked assets, that once you get a blocked asset, we can attach it. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless there's any other questions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is James Kerr. I'm with the firm of Davis Polk and Wardwell. I'm here on behalf of Bank of America National Association and Wells Fargo Bank National Association. I have ceded 5 minutes of my time Mr. Schultz, counsel for Amicus United States of America. As counsel for appellants mentioned, a preliminary question is the construction of the phrases in the Terrorism Risk Insurance Act and 1610G. We discuss in our brief the semantic arguments derived from the Supreme Court's case in Stanford. We also, discuss the dictionary definitions of the word of in the phrase blocked assets of that terrorist party and property of the terrorist party. I think what gives the word of a particularly striking meaning of ownership here is the fact that in each instance, TRIA and 1610G are placed into the context of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act in 1609 says that all property of a foreign state in the United States shall be immune except as provided in 1610 and 1611. 1610, in turn, through 1605A7 and 1605 Cap A, provide a defeasing of immunity in the case of terrorism claims. But the fact of the matter is that the only thing that the FSIA deals with and permits execution against is property that belongs to a foreign state. And I think that the use of in TRIA, it's used several times, but it's used the blocked assets of that terrorist party, and it goes on including the blocked assets of any agency or instrumentality of that terrorist party. Now, I would say that the first two instances pretty clearly indicate connote ownership, and I think that's also the case with the third usage, instrumentality of that terrorist party.
Let me ask you something. 201A came first.
Yes, sir.
And then 1610G was enacted.
Correct.
If we wipe 201A off the books now, right? What would the consequence of that be if the only thing that one had to rely on was 1610G? Could you still attach blocked assets?
Your Honor, I believe you could attach blocked assets. You would also
be able to... 1610G?
Under 1610G, yes. And I think
So 201A, under your view, really serves no continuing purpose after the enactment of 1610G?
Well, I know that the Defense Authorization Act of 2008 permits a party to proceed both under TRIA and under 1610G. I think that 1610G is an expansion of what you're entitled to get under TRIA. It permits you to go not only against blocked asset, it permits you to penetrate below the level of agencies or instrumentalities.
What I'm getting at is there's a canon of statutory construction dealing with redundancy. But this is different. I mean, if 201 had been enacted after 1610G, then that canon would really weigh against your argument. But it was enacted before, so what you had is a narrower statute because it only dealt with terrorism, and then a later broader one, which maybe rendered the earlier statute.
Well, I think that when TRIA was enacted, it was intended to make available to victims of terrorism blocked assets that had previously been held that it had not been available to them. And recognizing some of the problems that were posed by cases like Dole against Patrickson, which precluded a penetration below the initial level of corporate ownership.
Can you tell us, give us an example in one of these accounts, what we're dealing with and the amount of money there? Who has interests in the accounts? And is it in an interest-bearing account?
Your Honor, I think it's very important to realize what we are talking about here. And we're talking about blocked wire transfers. And I think that the most important documents in the record are the charts that appear at pages A2 and A3 of our appendix. And they are at 160 and 161 of the record. These describe the transactions that are subject to the blocking here. There is another set of transactions that are the subject of our interpleader petition. Your Honors, let me also point to the charts that appear at A7 and A5 of addendum to the brief, and they are also at 162 and 163 of the appendix. Basically, what you have...
I may have misunderstood you. I'm looking at the joint appendix here. I don't find any charts 182 or 83.
160 and 161.
Okay.
What
I wanted you to, so I can get this firmly in my mind, at least, give me an example. What kind of a transaction preceded the electronic transfer?
Your Honor, it could have been a purchase of goods between a party in Iran and a party in, Dubai.
They could be private parties.
Could be totally private parties.
And the transfer was interrupted before. The beneficiary's bank was an Iranian bank, then it could be blocked, even though both of the parties at either end of the transaction were private.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think if you take a look at the chart, what you will see is that we have shaded the party that caused the block in each instance. And all of the parties that caused the block are beneficiary banks. Beneficiary banks are really nothing but conduits to get the funds that are intended to go to, in the first instance, a trading company in Seoul. The third one, there is
an account at the Iranian bank. Is that right?
That is an account at the Seoul Korea branch of Bank Milan.
And that's an Iranian bank.
That is an Iranian bank, and it is designated as a specially designated national under the weapons of mass destruction. And these transactions were interrupted midstream. And an important aspect of Article 4A of the Uniform Commercial Code, which is adopted in the District of Columbia and in every state, is a very precise delineation of when a creditor can reach the property of a defendant. And Article 4A 502 sets out the very precise rules. Another very important rule in Article 4A is that when a transfer has been interrupted, as it has been here, and it's interrupted for more than 5 days, the transfer is canceled. And at that point, the intermediary bank that has canceled the transaction owes a debt back upstream. If you take a look at our chart...
To the originator bank?
To the originator bank and possibly the originator.
I understand all the UCC principles. What does G... I want to follow what Judge Randolph had started with a few minutes ago. What does G1 add to 1610?
Well, I think if
your argument is, I think the way you would have answered, I'm not sure I heard you answer to Judge Randolph, you don't need G1. 1610 does it all. The whole notion of property
application of UCC. I think 1610G is broader than TRIA, and it also contains that proviso that Judge Randolph asked counsel for the appellant, which requires or permits a judge to protect the interest of a party who is not liable on the judgment.
Well, which statutory provision are you talking about now?
It is one of the, it's 1610.
No, 1610?
It's one of the subdivisions of 1610.
So then what does G1 add?
It is the, notwithstanding anything in this subsection shall be construed to supersede the authority of the court to prevent appropriately the impairment of an interest held by a person who is not liable in the action giving rise to a judgment in property subject to the attachment.
In the section that says the property of a foreign state against which a judgment has been entered under 1605A and blah, 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 is subject to attachment in aid of execution. What does that add to 1610A?
Well, I think if it basically goes back to the fundamental principle that if you have a judgment against a defendant, you are permitted to attach and execute against that party's...
Okay, I get that. Now, isn't that what you say 1610 does as well?
I believe 1610 confirms that principle, absolutely.
There's no value added then with G, which is what Judge Randolph... I'm trying to understand the answer to his question. Why both?
I think that the Congress, in enacting 1610G, was responding to the limitations imposed on execution by Dole against Patrickson and perhaps by the decision of the Supreme Court in Elahi. In Elahi, the Supreme Court determined that an arbitration award that was owed to Iran was not subject to execution under this particular provision because it was not did not represent a blocked asset at that particular time. So I think that 1610G permits you to go against en bloc property. It also permits you to penetrate below the level of a directly owned subsidiary. And I think that's important. But again, going back to the framework in the Article 4A, what you have is a scheme when a provision is canceled, you go back upstream. And if the originator is an Iranian party, then I think you do the interpleader because it's possible that it is the terrorist party that has an ownership claim to the funds. And I guess one point I would like to make in closing that I think the way the money back guarantee provision works is consistent with the way that OFAC on blocks regimes like the sanctions that are in place for Cuba and Iran and the way they previously unblocked transactions for Vietnam, North Korea, and Kosovo. And we cite those at page 41 of our brief. And I thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr.
including the extra time.
May it please the Court, Benjamin Schultz on behalf of the United States. The plaintiff's position in this case is that they may attach property that is not owned by the judgment debtor simply because the judgment debtor has some tangential interest less than an ownership interest. That surprising proposition is contrary to the common law principles of execution that the Supreme Court recognized in United States versus Rogers and that we've cited elsewhere in our brief. And that surprising proposition, we submit, is not an appropriate interpretation of the text. Furthermore, it's also one that, at least with regard to 1610G, is one that Congress rejected in its legislative history. And we cite in our brief the fact that the conference report for the statute that created 1610G talked about that provision as reaching ownership interests. Now, I do want to briefly address both Judge Randolph's question and Judge Edwards' question, because I think there were some questions about what 1610 does that's different from TRIA, and there's a couple differences that I want to make sure the Court understands. The first difference is that TRIA only reaches blocked assets, whereas 1610 is not restricted to blocked assets. And in fact, it's quite possible, depending on how you interpret 1610G, it's not clear whether 1610G even authorizes you to override blocking. Now, that's something that we haven't taken a position on in this case, but depending on what you interpret 1610G2 to mean, you might interpret G2 to mean that it only overcomes sovereign immunity defenses, not that it overcomes the otherwise applicable requirement that you seek a license from OFAC. The other thing that I want to make sure the Court understands about 1610G that differentiates it from TRIA is that TRIA applies to both foreign state sponsors of terrorism and terrorist entities that are not state sponsors, whereas Section 1610 is only about state sponsors of terrorism. And furthermore, TRIA, because it talks about agencies or instrumentalities, TRIA came before the Supreme Court's decision in Dole Foods versus Patrickson. So TRIA would generally be understood then as only reaching first-level subsidiaries, whereas because 1610G has that language about indirect ownership, and it came after Dole Foods, TRIA is generally understood to mean that you can also reach second-level subsidiaries. So, for example, if Iran had an Iranian-owned bank, the bank would be an agency or instrumentality, and under TRIA you could get it. But then if the bank owned another company, that second company wouldn't be an agency or instrumentality under the Supreme Court's decision in Patrickson. 1610G doesn't have that same restriction because it talks about indirect ownership. So under 1610G, you could get to that second-level bank's assets. If there are no further questions,
You don't subscribe to the trial court's preemption analysis, do you?
Your Honor, we haven't taken any position on preemption. We've simply taken a position on the ownership.
You're not here to say please endorse that, right?
We have not taken a position on it, Your Honor.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, then I thank the Court for its time.
You have a minute?
Thank you, Your Honor, and I'll be under a minute. Only one point I wanted to emphasize that I didn't emphasize earlier was there's another clause, I think, in TRIA that's important, and that's the first sentence. And that first sentence says, notwithstanding any other provision of law. And that really gets back to the appellant's position as to the breadth of TRIA and the congressional intent of TRIA to compensate victims of terror, because at that time and even now, We face all types of obstacles, including obstacles in the executive branch of the government with respect to collecting against these judgments. The only other thing I want to point out, because it's hot off the press, and that I only read it on my computer last night, is there's only three cases that I'm aware of that have addressed the specific issues that were addressed below. There was the Hausler opinion, there was the Calderon-Carrera opinion, and then last night another opinion came out in the Levin case, which we're a party to. It's Levin versus the Bank of New York. It's 09-5900 in the Southern District of New York. And in that case, Judge Patterson yesterday issued an opinion addressing the exact issues that's before the court here and went the same way that Hauser went.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted.